Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Two of Claude Monet's paintings of the garden at his home in Vétheuil, France, have been reunited for the first time since they were created more than 100 years ago, thanks to a long-term series of loan exchanges between the National Gallery of Art, Washington, and the Norton Simon Museum, Pasadena. On July 15, 2018, in celebration of this special installation, Kimberly A. Jones, curator of 19th century French paintings at the National Gallery of Art, discussed the genesis of the four versions of the artist's garden at Vétheuil and their place within the larger context of Monet's artistic development during his three-year sojourn at Vétheuil, a period marked by personal tragedy and intense creativity.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Gallery of Art. I'm Kimberly Jones, curator of 19th century French paintings, and I'm very pleased to talk to you today about a particularly interesting subject related to our collections, the paintings that Monet produced at the village of Vétheuil. Now, the reason for this is thanks to a remarkable exchange program the National Gallery has been involved with since 2007 with the Norton Simon Museum of Art in Pasadena. The Norton Simon Museum is not terribly well known on the East Coast. They do not traditionally lend to exhibitions, but as a result of this extraordinary exchange program, we have been able to send masterpieces from the National Gallery's collection to Pasadena, and in exchange, they have sent masterpieces from their own collection to be shown in the permanent collections alongside relevant works of art. This is the fourth exchange to come to us from the Norton Simon Museum. And for this, we chose a painting of The Artist's Garden at Vétheuil by Claude Monet. This is the first time these two paintings have been exhibited together publicly. And in fact, it is the first time they've been in the same space together since 1882. So this is a remarkably rare opportunity to see two great masterworks by the master impressionist Claude Monet. The reason that we wanted to do this at this particular moment in time was, of course, due to our great painting, The Artist's Garden at Vétheuil, a work that came to us from the collection of Elsa Mellenbruce in 1970. I'm showing you this painting as it appeared before conservation. It was recently restored in our conservation studios, and the transformation has been quite extraordinary. As you can see, looking at the painting on the right, how incredibly luminous it is, the wonderful nuances of color, the heaviness, particularly in the foreground and in the sky, has been removed. You can really see the wonderful subtle and delicate tonalities that Monet incorporated into his great impressionist paintings, the beautiful shades of pink and lavender that are so remarkable, as well as the very powerful texture and the impasto in the paint surface. It really is a painting that has been truly revitalized. So we thought, what better way to showcase our painting than to bring it together with the painting from the Norton Simon collection? Now, the history of Monet's time in Vétheuil is a very interesting one, and perhaps not as well known as the time that he spent in Argenteuil, or of course, the end of his lifetime at Giverny, the site that continues to be most closely associated with the artist. He moved there in late 1878, in the fall of 1878, and I'm showing you here a map, and you can see Vétheuil located on the map, as well as Paris. Vétheuil was not exactly a tourist site, shall we say. It was located about 60 kilometers from Paris. There were no rail stations nearby. The closest rail station, in fact, was 10 kilometers away. It was a tiny agrarian hamlet. In fact, it only had 622 inhabitants when Monet arrived there, which is only about a tenth of the population of Argenteuil, where he'd been living before. It was pure, untouched paradise in many ways. It was a beautiful agrarian pastoral environment, which Monet responded to greatly. Its greatest claim to fame and most notable characteristic is its beautiful 13th century church, Notre-Dame de Vétheuil, which you can see rising up in the center of this photograph, and which in fact appears as a regular motif in Monet's painting. So there's a wonderful sense that this is a look backwards in time, something that is timeless, that is untouched by modernization and the transformation of time. Monet relished this location, the natural beauty that he found there. He described it as a ravishing spot from which I should be able to extract some things that aren't bad, he said rather modestly shortly after he arrived in Vitoya. And indeed, it proved very true. During the 3 years that he spent in Vitoya, he produced nearly 300 paintings. It was actually more than twice the paintings he had produced in the previous 8 years at Argentoya. So it was a period of intense productivity. His reasons for going to Vitoya were manifold. Mostly pragmatic. First and foremost, expense. He was struggling financially. Indeed, for much of his career, certainly into the 1890s, Monet grappled with money. By 1879, he was earning about half of what he had earlier in the decade, partly due to the fact that his regular dealer, Durand Ruel, was no longer buying Impressionist paintings. He was actually struggling himself financially, and so was not patronizing the young Impressionists. He also had growing commitments, because now Monet has a wife, Camille, but also two children. Camille had their second son, Michel, in March of 1878, so now he has three mouths to feed. He also wanted a more peaceful environment for Camille. After the birth of Michel, Camille's health declined significantly. There's lots of speculation as to what was the cause of this, if it was the after effect of the birth. Some have postulated that perhaps she may have actually been suffering from cancer, particularly possibly ovarian cancer, which we don't know. But her health was very severe, and so moving to somewhere much quieter, more peaceful, and less expensive was beneficial. And of course, the appeal of Argentoya had lost some of its luster. Argentoya was much closer to Paris, it was suburban, and it had quite a bit of industry in around the area. So it felt increasingly modern. And so Monet very consciously makes an attempt, and he continues to do this throughout his career, moving farther and farther from Paris, trying to escape modernization, industrialization, looking for a pure, more pristine state of nature where he could really experience and explore nature in its purest form. So the move to Vitoya was a very sensible one. He moves to Vitoya, and it's, a very curious development is he didn't move there alone. In addition to Camille and their two sons, Jean and Michel, he was joined by the Hochaday family, the wife and six children of Ernest Hochaday, and they moved into this house in Vitoya. And you can see, in fact, the lovely plaquette. By the way, this particular house is now a bed and breakfast. So should you be inclined and decide that you too want to have the full-on Monet Vitoya experience, they have two rooms. You can go on booking.com and other sites and you can find them. And if you want to, you can go to Vitoya and live like Monet, if one so desires. This is actually a very new development. I've not been there yet myself, but it is on my bucket list, shall we say. This was a very interesting situation, as you can imagine, having these two sort of merged households. It reads more like the narrative of a sitcom than actual history, and definitely was not terribly conventional. The relationship between Monet and the Hochaday family was one that went back for several years. Ernest Hochaday was a department store magnate and merchant of fabrics, quite successful, quite wealthy. He lived a very extravagant lifestyle. He and his wife Alice and their family lived in a beautiful townhouse in Paris in a very fashionable neighborhood. They also owned a wonderful chateau at Montgeron, which is located about 18 kilometers southeast of Paris. So it was kind of their lovely little country getaway, this very sumptuous house, which included decorations painted by Claude Monet. So it was a place where they entertained very lavishly and lived this wonderful, luxurious lifestyle until he went bankrupt, partly because of the extravagant life he was living. But he was also a collector of Impressionist paintings and modern art in general. And in fact, he owned 48 Impressionist paintings, including 16 by Monet. When he went bankrupt, he was forced to sell his works at auction, which proved to be disastrous because the prices they fetched were well below market value. The Impressionist market in 1878, the sale, I should say, took place in June of 1878, just months before the Monet clan moved to Vitoya. The Impressionist market had been in a bit of a slump in the late 1870s. Again, His primary dealer was no longer acquiring Impressionist paintings. They were not doing well at the market. And having all of these paintings go under the on the block and going for very low prices, in many cases, significantly below what they had been paid for just years before, had devastating effect on the Impressionist market. So it made things even worse for the poor and fortunate Monet. But nevertheless, he welcomed the Hochedey family into his household, in part because Alice, the wife of Ernest Hochedey, was there to help take care of Camille and help take care of the newborn Michel and his other son Jean. I'm showing you here a photograph of the two blended families in 1886 with all of them together. The two sons of Monet on the left, the two other sons of the Hochedey family and their four daughters, as well as Alice, who would later go on to be the second Madame Monet and Monet himself. It was, to say the least, a very complicated relationship. Now, during his time at Vitoya, Monet explored the landscape in all its various forms. But there was one subject that held particular attraction for Monet, and that was the garden. He painted at least 9 paintings of his garden at Vitoya, and it's a subject that he would turn to again and again, a subject that goes back well into the 1860s in the artist's work. In 1881, he begins a group of 4 related canvases, in a private collection, another one in a private collection, the painting in the Norton Simon collection, and the painting of the National Gallery of Art. I show these in relative scale, how they are relationship. The two middle paintings are, in fact, the same dimensions, and the first painting is significantly smaller than all of them. We do not know the exact chronology of the paintings. Historically, it's been assumed that he probably worked from the smallest, working his way up to the most grandiose. That is a very traditional way of approaching paintings. And indeed, before the painting from the Norton Simon arrived here, that was largely what we assumed. We are no longer entirely convinced of that particular chronology. It's, I think, much more complicated than that. But it's very telling that Monet is taking the single subject, the single viewpoint for the most part, slightly different in the painting at the far left, a slightly different angle. You're viewing it a little more from the right, whereas in the other 3 paintings, you're viewing the staircase straight on. Why would he do this? What is his motivation? Why is he painting 4 paintings that are so closely related in subject and composition at the same time? Why was he doing this? Well, that's what we don't really entirely know. We have a lot of speculation. We believe that they began in the summer of 1881. The presence of the sunflowers certainly would imply that these are indeed summer paintings. But of course, the question is, were they all done on site? Were they all done at once? Or were they created from a model or models? Could one or more of these paintings serve as the source material for the later paintings? Or were all 4 paintings done on site, en plein air, in the garden itself? And that is something that we don't entirely know. And what is that chronology? Well, as I said, it's complicated, and it really is very difficult to ascertain how these paintings relate to one another. He may have been referring to the National Gallery painting in a letter that he wrote to his dealer, Durand Ruel, in October of 1881, in which he says, "I have even begun a large canvas, and I want to do so many things before leaving Vitoya." Now, since the Washington painting is one of the largest paintings he produced in Vitoya, that would seem to be perhaps a key. Perhaps he is referring to that painting in the letter. Though there is a little sort of curious point, the dating of the painting. The other paintings are actually dated 1881. The Washington painting is signed and dated 1880. I'll get back to the sort of curious confusion about that date a little later in the lecture. Now, as I said, gardens were a subject that held particular allure for Monet. He was fascinated with them beginning quite early in his career. And I'm showing you here 2 very famous examples of garden scenes by Monet dating from the 1860s, The Woman in the Garden, Saint-Étresse, on the left, and his very famous Women in a Garden from 1866, which some of you may have remembered was actually here last year in the Frederic Bazille exhibition just downstairs. Wonderful opportunity to see it. In these spaces, these are not private gardens, per se. These are much more public spaces, shared spaces. These are other people's gardens, gardens that are open to the general public rather than intimate private spaces. So there is a clear distinction between what is happening in his garden paintings in the 1860s versus what he will do later on. When he gets to Argenteuil, however, this is the first time he actually has a garden of his own that he is able to tend, cultivate, and paint. And so you see, of course, a very famous painting in the National Gallery's collection of the artist garden at Argenteuil. And on the right, a painting by Renoir showing Monet painting in his garden at Argenteuil. It's a very meta kind of relationship. But it does speak to that fascination with the garden itself. But if there's another theme that really haunts Monet's art throughout this period, it's also his wife, Camille Doncieux, Camille Monet. She is probably even more prevalent than even the gardens themselves. The relationship between Monet and Camille was a complicated one. She was born in 1847, the daughter of a merchant. In her teens, she began to work as an artist model, and that's when, in 1865, the 18-year-old Camille met Claude Monet, who was 7 years his elder, and she became more or less exclusively his model, later becoming his mistress and eventually his wife. Monet's family did not approve of the liaison. They certainly did not approve that they had a child out of wedlock. That was, and in fact, Monet's father encouraged Monet to abandon Camille and the unborn child, which we consider very scandalous. To his credit, Monet did not. He remained loyal to Camille, but because he was dependent upon his family for funding, he actually went off to Sainte-Adresse, where his father and his aunt were living, and left poor Camille back in Paris sort of on her own with a newborn child, which was, as you can imagine, not an ideal situation, because that was the only way he could sort of see to move forward. Nevertheless, Camille remained staunchly by his side. They had their first son, Jean, in August of 1867. And finally, 3 years later, in 1870, they were wed in a civil ceremony. So they were married in 1870 at long last. Camille appears again and again as Monet's greatest subject and muse. For example, she is the model for all the women in The Women in the Garden. You can see her very distinctive features, particularly in the woman in the foreground with her dark, heavy eyes and dark hair, and even turns her into a redhead because since she was his girlfriend, he didn't actually have to pay her to pose for him at that point. Made her very convenient as a model. But she appears again and again in small, intimate paintings, such as the one on the right, as well as his major salon productions. In 1866, Monet exhibited the painting on the left, The Woman in a Green Dress, to much fanfare. It was actually quite the success at the Paris Salon, this very large, life-size painting of Camille wearing a very elegant ensemble. And of course, she posed for his famous painting, The Déjeuner sur l'Herbe, and appears as multiple figures in the painting, and particularly the woman in the white dress you see on the left, very clearly identifiable. And then again, in other large-scale paintings, such as La Japonaise, the painting on the left, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, where she's wearing a blonde wig to heighten that sense of exoticism and seductiveness that goes alongside this beautiful Japanese kimono that he's dressed her in, trying to sort of tap into the Japanomania going through France, this fascination with all things oriental and exotic, and a much more subtle but extraordinarily beautiful painting from the National Gallery's collection, The Woman with the Parasol, showing Camille standing on a hillock, which in many ways is the most perfect Impressionist painting I think one could ever see, that wonderful sense of freshness and vitality as Camille stands and suddenly turns to gaze at the viewer and the artist himself. And of course, you see her in gardens. Always, always, she returns to the garden, very much ensconced in this beautiful, luxurious setting, particularly in the garden at Argenteuil, as you can see in both of these paintings, particularly in the painting on the right, where she's dressed very elegantly. She feels very much like a Parisian woman visiting a garden rather than someone inhabiting her own space. But no matter what the nuance, no matter what the mood, Camille is always a present figure. Just showing you two more paintings of Camille in these settings. On the left, the garden at Argenteuil itself, and in the right, in a meadow outside of Argenteuil, as she lies in the flowers, surrounded by these beautiful yellow and white blossoms. It's a wonderful image of the freshness of springtime, the beauty of the color, the luminosity. It's a quite extraordinary image. Now, unfortunately, Camille's health continued to decline, and in September of 1879, she passed away. Monet commemorated the event by painting this extraordinary painting of Camille on her deathbed, a very haunting, very moving image. This speaks to the attachment that he felt to his wife and the grief that he was feeling. This begins a very fraught period in Monet's life. As I've mentioned, up to this point, he's grappling financially. He's been having to sort of struggle with Camille's failing health. But now everything seems to come to a head. Everything begins to, in many ways, to fall apart. It's a period of very difficult transition in the career of Claude Monet, which is just heightened by the loss of his wife, who had stood beside him for some 14 years prior to her death. Now, nature itself seemed to be giving a nod to Monet's own internal landscape. In the winter of 1879-1880, this winter was one of the harshest on record up to that point. It was a very intensely, bitterly cold winter. I'm showing you here actually an etching by Félix Bouhot of winter in Paris, and you can see all these vignettes along the side, including horses that have actually collapsed in the street from the extreme cold. In the lower left, a group of men who are huddled around a fire, trying to keep warm, trying to stave off the frigid cold. It was a very fraught moment in terms of what was going on in Paris, and of course was continuing on into Vatouille. Now, the winter, in fact, got so bad that in December of 1879, the Seine froze over. The ice was so thick, it was actually measured as 50 centimeters thick. So it was a very dense amount of ice. When the thaws came, which began later in December and through March, this created a terrible disaster. There was incredible flooding. Two bridges were swept away, and ice flows were floating along the Seine. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. For Monet, however, this became an opportunity. Rather than wallowing in his own personal winter, he began to find inspiration and indeed produced some 28 paintings depicting the thaw. I mean, a literal and metaphorical thaw in nature as well as in his own artistic inspiration. They are an extraordinary body of paintings as he sort of explores this wonderful sense of cold, the subtle variation of light and color, showing some of them, for example, the painting on the left from the Shelburne on a bright sunny day with this beautiful, intensely vivid blue sky reflecting in the ice flow below. The painting on the right, a more muted gray day. What we see here is something very interesting, and why I have said this period in Vatouille is really very significant and transitional. We see here just the first hints of seriality in his paintings. These paintings are not true series paintings in the sense of the works that he would later do in the 1890s of Rouen Cathedral or the grain stacks or the poplar trees, where he would fix a very specific site and very vantage point and explore them in various atmospheric effects. These paintings lack the rigor, they lack the precision of those later paintings, but he's beginning to tease around the notion of what happens when you take a single subject and begin to explore it over time as light changes, as you move from gray days into sunny days. How does that impact the subject itself? What comes forth, trying to sort of capture those variations. This will become a central theme in his art in coming years, but he's just starting to sort of hone in on this and recognize the importance. He'd always been interested in atmospheric effects. That, after all, is what Impressionism is all about. It's about capturing the nuances and the subtleties and the spontaneity of nature, but now trying to do it in a more carefully controlled and calculated way, trying to sort of control the factors to create something that is ultimately a more rigorous kind of image of nature as it's being impacted by those subtle variations. And he begins to sort of also become meditative and looking backwards. For example, this painting of the sunset of the Seine at L'Avant-Corps, winter effect, a very large painting he did in 1880 showing the winter effects, which is in many ways a reprise of his very famous painting, Impression Sunrise, that he painted 8 years previous. And I'm showing you these paintings in, again, once in relative scale. So the painting from the Marmottan is quite small, whereas the painting in the Petit Palais is quite large. But you can see there are definite similarities that he is actually thinking on and sort of working through an intellectual puzzle in these paintings. It's not just a visceral visual experience, but there's actually a great deal of premeditation and a great deal of thought that goes into these paintings. For all their presumed and apparent spontaneity, there is a great deal of premeditation. And as I said, this period is a difficult one for Monet. He is grappling financially. And so in the spring of 1880, he does something quite extraordinary. He returns to the Paris Salon. Monet, like the other Impressionists, had started their careers exhibiting at the Paris Salon, which was the great annual exhibition. It was the place to show your art, the place to be recognized, and the place to really make a reputation. But beginning in the early 1870s, the young Impressionists had moved away because they were constantly rejected and constantly frustrated, and ultimately mounted their own exhibition so that they could create their own space and build their reputations through that way. The Impressionist exhibitions were difficult. Oftentimes, they were not terribly successful. They were more mocked than praised in their exhibitions. But nevertheless, that was an opportunity. But in 1880, Monet made the choice to turn his back on the Impressionists, and recognizing that he probably would be getting a lot of criticism from his colleagues, and he returned to the Paris Salon. He made his way back to through the doors of the establishment. And the painting that was accepted at that year is this one, the Seine et l'Avant-Corps. So this actually, what we are seeing is the opposite side of the Seine. So we are viewing it more or less from the side of Vitoya. The two villages faced one another across the river. There was no bridge. There was actually only a ferry if you wanted to go across, or Monet could use, he actually had a boat. He had a little boat studio that he used that allowed him to travel along the Seine. And so he chooses the subject from Vitoya. And this painting was exhibited and actually was fairly well accepted. It was badly placed, not surprisingly. He was not a name. He was not a recognized and respected artist but in the mainstream sense. Nevertheless, it did receive quite a bit of positive commentary. Emile Zola, the great writer and art critic, praised Monet as an incomparable landscapist, while the conservative art critic, the Marquis de Chenevière, who actually was a former minister of fine arts, wrote in the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, the most prestigious and conservative art journal of the day, that the luminous and clear atmosphere makes all the nearby landscapes in the same gallery seem black. So the fact that the sort of old, both modern, you know, avant-garde critics such as Zola and the conservative old guard were recognizing Monet's talents did actually mean a great deal to him. Now, the painting was not purchased at the exhibition, but it was later purchased by his dealer, Durand Ruel, in 1881, which is a point where he was, in fact, finally returning to buy Impressionist paintings in 1881. So this actually marks a kind of uptick in Monet's status and his financial situation. Now, not everything was still rosy. In January of 1880, one of the journals in Paris wrote a rather scathing journal in Le Gallois. It wrote an article about the Hochede clan. And the journal announced a mock funeral reporting the grievous loss of Claude Monet, who was living in Vitoya with his charming wife, Alice Hochede. Keeping in mind that, of course, they were not married. She was living in the Monet household after Camille's death, and they were not married. She was still married to Ernest Hochede. This was, of course, very scandalous and very shocking, And the fact that it was now being announced publicly heightened the scandal. In fact, the following month, all the household staff left the Monet household. So they had no more servants because they didn't want to be associated with this scandalous household. So it continues to be a complicated and difficult period in Monet's career. But artistically, he's undergoing a renaissance. He is producing extraordinarily beautiful paintings. He is once again selling to his dealer, Drandruel. And as I said, he's beginning to sort of work his way through the interesting puzzle of seriality as he continues to pick subjects and vantage points and motifs and explores them in different atmospheric effects. Here you see one such example of two paintings showing the road of Vatoya. On the left, you have a springtime scene with the green hillocks in the background. And on the right, you have a painting in winter. Again, they are not precisely the same scene. They're not quite the same vantage point. But nevertheless, they share enough commonalities in the curving of the road, the hillock in the background, the church peeking up at the far left, to make them an interesting pair and to once again show how Monet is sort of thinking his way through depicting motifs. Here's another one. Again, it is not a direct comparata. They are not a pair of canvases. Once again, the vantage point in the painting on the right is from farther away. This one feels as if it is from as if we are on the banks of the village of Lavaucourt, looking across the Seine, whereas the one on the left feels as if we are perhaps on the water itself, perhaps in Monet's boat studio, viewing the painting from a closer vantage point. But again, the way he is sort of playing with framing suggests that he is thinking about the relationship of these paintings across time. And then he does something curious, like this particular pair of paintings in the National Gallery of Art, the painting on the right, which came to us from the Chesterdale collection, and the painting on the left, which recently introduced from the Corcoran collection. They are, in fact, essentially the same viewpoint, but notice how he's playing with the composition. He is using a horizontal format on the left and a vertical on the right, which is very strange for a figural painting. And he has many of the same elements. You can see the same houses peeking through the trees. You have these very thin poplar trees and then that wonderful willow tree. So essentially, we are just shifting a few steps to one side to have the same viewpoint. Only one includes the figure seated beneath the willows, and the other includes no figures at all. One thing that one finds, actually, in the paintings at Vatoya is a relative lack of human presence. That most of these paintings, and as I've been showing you, do not have human figures. The exception, of course, are the gardens. And a painting like this, which presumably this is Alice or one of her daughters who is posing, but a painting that very much harkens back to the paintings that he did of Camille in their own garden. So let's go back to where we started, the two paintings of the artist's garden at Vatoya. As I said, we were very fortunate to have this painting come. They have not been seen together since 1882. The painting on the left was sold to Drandruel in February of 1882, while the painting on the right stayed with Monet for quite a bit longer. I should caution you to not make too much of the color differential, which you can see in the paintings upstairs. Partly this is because the painting on the left is varnished, whereas the painting on the right is not. Monet talks about whether or not to varnish paintings, and it was the decision of our conservator in consultation with curators that he probably wouldn't have varnished a painting such as this, so we actually have it glazed instead. So the result of the varnish is it heightens color, it saturates. So the colors in the painting on the left from the Norton Simon Museum feel much more vivid and more intense and more saturated. There's nothing wrong with the painting. There's no reason to remove the varnish. It's in beautiful condition. Unlike our painting, which the varnish had darkened and gone sort of yellow and sort of dull and really was disfiguring the painting in the way that the varnish is not on the painting on the left. So just so you know, there's a reason behind this. It has nothing to do with Monet and everything to do with how the paintings are presented today. Now, these paintings, as I said, are a very interesting group because they present with a lot of questions, but not a lot of answers. We were very fortunate to be able to have the painting from the Norton Simon in our conservation studio for several days prior to the painting being installed. We spent a lot of times with the the curator, Emily Talbot, from the Norton Simon Museum, came with the painting. We spent a lot of time looking and talking and sort of hashing out ideas about these paintings and what the relationship might be between them. And we noticed some very interesting things. One thing we noticed, actually, let me go back, which of course is well known, is the presence of these so-called jardiniere, these blue and white porcelain vases, which you see in all these paintings. They are kind of a leitmotif in Monet's gardens. You first see them in Argenteuil. You see them popping up in his garden paintings. And you see more and more. Interestingly enough, they seem to sort of have a sliding scale. In the painting on the left, the porcelain vases are quite large. The vase, actually, you see on the left, almost seems to come up to Camille's knee. But when you look at the painting on the right, they seem much smaller in scale. So he's playing a little fast and loose with all of this and how they apply. And of course, he has them in interior spaces and exterior spaces. But clearly, there was something meaningful to him. There was a certain, perhaps a sentimental attachment to them. And I'm showing you on the right, this is actually a jardiniere from Monet's collection. That just came up for auction this past November in Hong Kong. And you can see very clearly that it is, in fact, the same jardiniere. So he is incorporating his same motifs. We also found made interesting discoveries in the sky. Now, one thing that sort of became very interesting to us is how fresh the painting in Washington is. For example, in the sky, when he painted it, he left behind reserves, that there are areas in the sky that were left with bare canvas, and he painted the blue around them, and then came back in later to paint the clouds. And you can sort of see along the edges how thin the paint is, that he came back in with paint afterwards. Actually, let me go back so you can see. You'll notice that these paintings, of the four, they're the only ones that have clouds, and the clouds are positioned in the exact same place in both paintings. So what does this mean? That the Washington painting, clearly he planned out where the clouds would go, whereas in the Norton Simon painting, the clouds are painted over blue sky. So they were not necessarily part of the original plan. We also noticed, and I invite you to go upstairs and look more carefully, the pigment in the sky, there's green underneath, which seems very curious. Why would you have green underneath a blue sky? Unfortunately, X-rays did not provide much new information, but I do wonder if perhaps this might not be a case where Monet was reusing an old canvas. This was something he did quite a lot, particularly in the 1860s when he was cash-strapped. So he may well have had a landscape that had green grass and then flipped the canvas so that the bottom becomes the top. And so that green we see underneath may have nothing to do with the painting we now see, but in fact may be, you know, a result, sort of a lingering a presence of an older painting that is now long gone and is effaced. As I said, in X-rays and infrareds, we looked and we could find no details, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. If it was just a lay-in of green grass, for example, you wouldn't really see much of anything. So that might be one reason why he couldn't leave reserves. He couldn't leave bare canvas and then paint the sky around and let the clouds be fluffy. When you do this reserve, it creates that sort of softness, you know, this wonderful sort of soft quality and a kind of luminosity that you wouldn't get because if you had opaque paint and put white paint on top, it feels heavier by comparison. Instead, these clouds feel much fluffier because of the way they're painted. Now, and then we have the other painting, this other painting that's the same scale as the Norton Simon painting. As I mentioned, there are no clouds in the sky, but it does have one element that is of particular interest, and that is the presence of the two little boys who you see standing on the staircase. These are the only paintings of the four that have figures in them. So what does that mean? We know who the figures were. They are, in fact, the two youngest children in the Monet-Hochaudet families. Jean-Pierre Hochaudet and Michel Monet were born 7 months apart, and they were known commonly in the family as les petits, the little ones. And so they appear again and again in Monet's art. They were close friends, close associates. Monet shows them time and time again in his art, in these wonderful little drawings, and even this painting done some years later showing Michel and Jean-Pierre Rochedet together. And we know that they are the figures because Jean-Pierre himself confirmed in later correspondence that, in fact, he and Michel were the models. But then there's another curious element, and that is this. As you can see, I'm showing you the painting from the Norton Simon on the left and a detail on the right. And you'll notice this very odd paint, these sort of blue and white vertical streaks in the paint, and then over top, very heavy impasto of green paint pulled across. It's very, very high impasto, very present, to accentuate the steps. Why is that happening? What is going on? Well, when we looked very carefully at this and compared it to the Washington painting, it might be a figure. In the Washington painting, we have not only the two children, but the blue and white that appears to be a figure of a woman, perhaps one of, perhaps Alice Rochedet or one of her daughters, clearly standing on the staircase. And now it appears that at one point she may have also been present in the Norton Simon painting, but for whatever reason, Monet decided to erase her. So sort of scrubbed out some of the painting, but still left behind bits of the blue and white paint from the dress, which he then tried to sort of cover over with the horizontal strokes of paint to sort of hide it from our sight. And really, at the end of the day, when we come to these paintings, they are very much about an absence. The absence, of course, is not that of the mystery woman on the stairs. The absence is Camille. Camille, who had been such a prominent presence in Monet's art for the first 14 years of their lives together, but who is essentially erased from art and is replaced by Alice Rochedet, who eventually will become, who becomes Monet's mistress and eventually becomes his wife. It was not, however, you know, by the end of 1881, Alice was very clearly with Monet. Her husband was living in Paris, and Alice remained with Monet, moving with him and the family to Poissy and then to Giverny. And in 1891, after the death of Ernest Rochedet, Alice marries Claude Monet, and they become married, and they live together until Alice's death in 1911. So the second Mrs. Monet really slots in a little uncomfortably, easily, into the space once inhabited by Camille Doncieux. And then we have the after effects, these four paintings that Monet did of the artist's garden. What happens to them afterwards? Well, of the four, three of them left Monet's possession very early on. The smallest painting was sold in late 1881. The two paintings, including the Norton Simon painting, was sold in February of 1882. But the largest of the paintings, the painting now in the collection of the National Gallery, stayed with Monet for decades. We don't know exactly the year that it left. We were still doing research on that. But at least as late as 1908, the painting was still in Monet's possession. In fact, you can see it. I'm showing you two late photographs of Monet's studio at Giverny. So this painting remained with him, following him around, staying in his possession until very, very late. And in fact, you can see it actually next to the study part of the Déjeuner sur l'Herbe in the painting on the left, which you can see much more clearly on the slide on the left. So it was a painting that clearly had some importance for Monet. But is it the end game of all these paintings? Is it the last in a series of four paintings, the great culmination of more modest studies for the later, greater painting? Or is it what we are now beginning to think may very well have been the starting point, that this may have been the first in the series? And that date of 1880, which we assumed was a mistake, may be accurate. Now, why the date? Well, typically, artists don't sign and date paintings until they leave their possession. There's no reason to. The three small paintings left Monet's studio by 1882. So, of course, they were painted in relative proximity to their departure. So the dates are clear. We had assumed that the reason why our painting had the date 1880 was he was misremembering. The decades had passed. He had forgotten exactly when he painted it. All of our memories become a little more elusive as time passes, and he may have remembered only that he painted it in 18, in the 1880s when he was at Vitoya may have misremembered 1880 versus 1881. Or perhaps we've been wrong all along, that the painting's date is in fact accurate, that this was painted a year before, and that he then turned around at a later date in 1881 and painted these new versions, smaller versions, more marketable versions, and that this painting was very much the prototype, but one that he had a clear attachment to, and that is why he kept it while he sold off the other paintings, which were in fact the following paintings. These and many other questions are ones that we are still grappling with in relation to these paintings. We don't have any clear answers, so I encourage all of you, if you have not spent any time with the paintings upstairs in the West Building, to go over and ponder it for yourself. As I said, there's the wonderful thing about much of art history is it's not an exact science, and spending time with paintings can really completely transform your understanding and appreciation of what they mean and what they represent in an artist's art. And I'm very glad that we've had the opportunity to have the Norton Simon painting here, because it really has provoked some fascinating thoughts about Claude Monet and his art and his time that he spent in the village of Vitoya. So thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.